As a traveler, I'm all about getting beyond the surface of people and places and to better understand our world. But writer Robert McFarlane, he really takes that mission literally. In his book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey, Robert explores the Earth's underworlds, its caves, its catacombs, and deeply hidden places. He found himself drawn into the sunless sights that may have repulsed other people through the ages. In this subterranean world, he found a world of unburials, untimely surfacings that can be dazzling and they can be horror shows at the same time. Robert McFarlane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
I'm just fascinated by travel, and then somebody can expose to me a whole nother frontier, and that's this underground journey and this fascination with the underland. What bookends your whole approach to this? I mean, you were inspired to write this. Tell me a little bit about the context that you wrote this book in.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is I love mountains. That they have my heart. And the first book I ever wrote was about why we climb mountains. And you know, 15 years on, here I am trying to explain the opposite, the gravitational opposite. But the idea came in 2010, which was a year when it was hard not to think about the underworld, about the underland. That was the year when the Haitian earthquake shook the world. The Icelandic volcano stopped the flights of Europe and America, Eyjafjallajökull. It's the year when the Deepwater Horizon blowout occurred and when those 33 Chilean miners were trapped under the Atacama Desert and were brought out one by one in a space capsule. And I just remember watching those four things happen, watching those surfacings, natural and human, and just thinking about this raging world we stand on this thin crust. And I worked on that book for 8 years on and off, and I finished the last paragraphs as that Thai football team were trapped under the mountain by the rising waters.
Now, you know, when you think about those 33 miners, 700 meters deep underground in Chile, that's 2,000 feet. That's a third of a mile. And it was NASA, which is its expertise is in outer space, that was called in to rescue them.
They helped. They helped, absolutely. And very often space and the underworld collide. I was down in a dark matter research laboratory. You've got one in a Dakotan gold mine yourselves. That's where astrophysicists go to try and work out what the universe is made of. But they have to do it a mile underground because that shuts out the atomic noise of the world, of the universe, and allows them to listen carefully.
Robert, when I think of underland, I think of claustrophobia. How does claustrophobia tie in with your exploration of what's under our feet?
I think this is the only book I've ever written where I'm thrilled when someone writes to me and says, I couldn't read on. I had to put it aside. I was spasming. I had to get out into the sunlight. Claustrophobia fascinates me because you don't have to be there in a way that's not true with vertigo. You can feel profoundly claustrophobic just by reading about something someone else is doing. That as a writer, that interests me immensely because it means you have a power over your reader. You can grip them.
You know, I have that power when I read about climbing a mountain. I'm just gripping the couch as I'm reading, you know, when they're on the face of a cliff or something. And I have the same thing when I read some accounts in your book of claustrophobia. It was just like, I need a break from this.
Isn't that amazing? The power a writer has. It's very rare. You can shape the body and shake the body of your reader. It's a strong feeling. I mean, there were a couple of places where you felt the weight of the world pressing upon you.
And Robert, I can't help but think what we've all lived through with this pandemic. Is there any sort of poignancy with what you've learned in this book that is particularly applicable to where we're at today?
Well, I mean, there's a line in Underland that I wrote, to understand the light, you need first to have been buried in the deep down dark. And I wrote that long before Corona, but that's where we are now, still buried, I think. And the light, when we see it again, is dazzling and wonderful, and we remember what is astonishing and dear and precious to us.
Well, there's so much going on that is sort of almost existential challenges to us, and a lot of it is going to require for us being more sensitive and thoughtful about our environment. Much of the underworld is frozen. You call yourself an isaholic. What's an isaholic?
I think maybe an isaholic or a cryophile, depending on your
cryophile.
Your preference.
That's good.
Yeah, I love ice. Okay, that I think that high altitudes and high latitudes have my heart. I'm not a desert and a jungle person, and so it's always been about mountains and glaciers for me. So, yeah, I've written about them for as long as I've been writing.
I love what you write that glaciers are like creatures, the closest thing to living dead matter.
Yeah, they howl, they sing. They murmur, they mutter, they talk to themselves, and they move, of course. It's no coincidence that we talk about glaciers carving as though they were creatures. When a vast berg breaks off from the tidal face of a glacier, that's a carving. And indigenous languages fully recognize the liveliness of this moving ice.
We could gain an appreciation of glaciers, as we say in the States, I think, by just thinking how indigenous peoples respected glaciers. And one thing about them is how vast they are. I mean, they are just mind-bogglingly powerful.
Yeah. I mean, they're one of the most powerful erosive geomorphological forces on the planet. They can take out a mountain range, no problem. We know that. But they're also within our power to destroy. And I remember being in East Greenland, the remotest place I'd ever been, climbing there for weeks in the summer of 2016, the summer of greatest melt in Greenland at that time. And the ice was utterly powerful, awesome in a way I'd never seen in any other substance before. But it was also melting. It was retreating. Mm. We could see where the glaciers should have been. We heard stories of ships whose GPSs were screaming alarm at them, because the GPS recorded ice where there was no ice, so the ships could sail on through clear water.
You know, you talk about glaciers as being the closest thing to living dead matter. They sing, they crawl, they shatter, they rage. When you're mindful of the impact of climate change, it must be heartbreaking if you love the world to be on a glacier and to hear the shattering and the rage and the moaning.
Yeah, glaciers have always done that. Of course, that's what they do. They make that noise, but they make it faser now. And it is a kind of pain song. I think that's right.
A pain song, yes.
And a frightening one at that. I spoke to the inhabitants of the little village of Kulasuk in East Greenland. And actually for them, the mark of the glaciers going was silence. It wasn't noise, it was silence. They used to be able to hear its carving explosions from the village. But as it had retreated over 20, 30 years, it had gone around a corner and they couldn't hear the glacier anymore. That really struck to my heart.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Robert McFarlane, and his book is Underland, A Deep Time Journey. Robert's a fellow at Emmanuel College in Cambridge in England. And we're looking under the surface right now at what he reveals in his book, Underland. Robert, I'm fascinated by how you say in Underland, the underland is a world where you store what is precious and you dispose of what is harmful. What are some examples of storing what is precious and disposing what is harmful?
Well, the first thing we store is the bodies of our loved ones. We've been a burying species, and our predecessors were burying species. We're just starting to understand how long we've been burying our dead. The first cemetery known in Britain I've been into is 10,000 years old. These were people living hard, nomadic lives, but they still wish to place their dead somewhere safe. But states store data. The Svalbard seed vault is where we store all the world's seeds that we think we might need after an apocalypse to regrow a world. But even the Svalbard seed vault up in the Arctic isn't safe because it flooded when the permafrost melted around it.
This vault of what we can repopulate the world's vegetation and so on,
yeah.
It assumed that it would be locked in a frozen, in a permafrost, and that's changing, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, they placed this vault so far above the highest possible range that an Arctic tsunami could reach, but they didn't count on permafrost melting around the vault.
That's disturbing. And there's, along with that, there's what you call untimely surfacings, ancient methane deposits in the Arctic that are just going to be burped out as the permafrost thaws.
Burped out, exactly. I mean, this is happening again and again. It's happening through heat, and it's happening the River Elbe during the drought summer of a few years ago in Europe. They have these drought stones which become visible when the river's level drops, and they have messages on them. And one of them has this this message which translates as, if you see me, weep. And, you know, talk about a warning from the depth.
Imagine, and as you described in your book, Robert, that was from about 600 years ago. So some tribe was suffering through a drought, and they carved into that stone, if you see me, weep, knowing that future generations would be counting on that river to be there, and in bad times, it would expose that stone. And it's a poignant message from the past that we're all in this together.
That's brilliantly put. I mean, what a shiver down the spine of consolation and kindness, but also fear when you see that drought stone emerge.
Hmm. And we've got, talking about emerging, we've got Greenland revealing Cold War missile bases with toxic chemicals you talk about.
Yeah, that was an American project, straight out of the James Bond casting scene, that they would build a subglacial nuclear weapons base with a cinema generator, a small nuclear generator, hundreds of thousands of gallons of toxic material. And then they just left it, closed the door on it, because they thought the snow and the ice would bury it as it accumulated. But of course, it's no longer accumulating, so it's rising to the surface, another unburial.
Robert McFarlane teaches environmental humanities at Emmanuel College at Cambridge, where he's joining us from his home studio on Travel with Rick Steves. His book, Underland, won the Wainwright Prize. The Guardian called it one of the 100 best books of the 21st century. In it, he takes us to explore the world beneath our feet as we peer into the deep time of the planet's past. His earlier titles include Mountains of the Mind, Landmarks, The Wild Places, and The Old Ways. And Robert, I love it. Like, you're a tour guide for me. You're taking me out of my comfort zone. I'm curious, and it's all new to me. And that's what is so exciting about travel, is there's so many frontiers that are new to us, and you're taking me underground. And when you talk about underground, you don't want to know, is it today or tomorrow? You don't want to know, is it noon or 6 p.m.? You have a concept called deep time. And deep time is critical to understanding the underland. Tell us what deep time is.
Yeah, so this is the phrase is John McPhee's, the great New Yorker writer. Deep time is earth time. Deep time is measured in eons and epochs. It's not measured in minutes and years. It's not, these are not human units. We could think of it as the long now. It's a kind of vertigo when you think about it. We all try it, don't we? You stand on the Grand Canyon rim and you dream back in geological time. And it's dizzying and impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it absolutely sharpens the sense of miracle of nowness. We are here. We shouldn't be. Our species shouldn't be. We shouldn't have evolved, let alone us individual versions of our species standing on the rim of that jaw-dropping space.
Oh, yeah. It's like time-lapse. It's our reality in time-lapse. And sometimes you see things you wouldn't see otherwise if you can do a time-lapse. And this is a time-lapse of time-lapse. Where, as you write, ice breathes, the rock has tides, mountains rise and fall, we live on a restless earth. I remember standing, and there's a waterfall in Switzerland in Lauterbrunnen Valley. It's called Trommelbach Falls, and it's a river that's carved itself deep into the mountain, and it's just a stony world, and you go into that. You hike literally into the mountain, and it's a black and white world filled with mist and the thunder of the river, and it just seems to me this river is like God's bandsaw cutting through the earth. And if you can get your brain around deep time, you can see this bandsaw at work.
That's a brilliant description. And yeah, that bandsaw has been patient, right? It's taken hundreds of thousands of years to do its cutting. Deep time is tilts into the future as well. And I guess that's what came to fascinate me about it as I travel. I kept thinking that when you descend into the underland, you descend into the past. But actually, in many ways, you head into the future as well. In Finland, at Onkalo, the hiding place, as it translates there, they're building a deep geological repository for high-level nuclear waste. They're basically creating a sarcophagus that can keep the worst stuff we've made as a species and keep it safe for 100,000 years. And they're also thinking there, how do we communicate the danger of this place, which will last for millennia? They're thinking ahead. I went to that place expecting it to be hell, to be the end of the world. And I came away oddly exhilarated by the responsibility that was being exercised there. That's deep time into the future. That's a careful legacy leaving that they're doing.
And is this an initiative of the Finnish people? Because it sounds like it's a multinational undertaking, and the whole world should be thankful for this.
It's a Finnish initiative for Finnish waste. They put basically a penny on the energy tax back in the 1970s, and they've used that war chest to deal with their own waste, and I admire them for it. But no other country has managed to do this.
You know, there's kind of an ethical dimension of deep time. You know, should we even care? Should we be inspired into action? Or should we just say, let's be apathetic, because it really doesn't matter in the deep time? But then you got this wonderful question that Jonas Salk asks, are we being good ancestors? What's your take on that, considering deep time? Is it just like it's futile anyways, or do we have some responsibility to be good stewards?
Yeah, we have responsibility. And what a question it is. Are we being good ancestors? It stops you, it searches you, probes your heart, probes your conscience. To be a good ancestor doesn't mean to be a good parent. It doesn't mean to be a good grandparent. It means to be responsible to people you will never meet, generations you will never meet, species that haven't existed yet. And that's hard. We're not very good at that. We're not good at being kind to the people closest to us sometimes.
Imagine if that sensibility, if that ethic was woven into our way of consuming and our way of voting and our way of loving. Oh, that would be
transformative.
It would be transformative. It'd be something we as a species, as a society, as an age could be proud of. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Robert McFarlane, and his book is Underland, A Deep Time Journey. Robert's known for works that explore landscape and their connection to the human heart. His earlier books include Mountains of the Mind, Wild Places, The Lost Worlds, The Old Ways, and Landmarks. He's also co-written a book called Ghost Ways after exploring some of England's most mysterious landscapes. We have links to Robert's works with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And Robert, just reading through your book, it's travel. It's travel. And a lot of travelers are given an object, or they find an object, or they pack along an object that has a special meaning to them. Have you ever, in your quest for a better appreciation of the underland, carried with you or been given some small object that has a surprising meaning to you that you might want to share?
Yeah. I mean, yes, you're right. We all carry our amulets and our charms, don't we? In the mountains, I love to carry red hot chilies. So when I'm cold, I eat a raw chili and it vims me up. But what I carried in the underland was an owl, an owl made of whalebone that had taken from the carcass of a minke whale that had washed up on the shores of the Outer Hebrides. And an artist friend made it, cut the whalebone into the form of an owl, a little white owl, the size of my palm, thin as a coin. And he gave it to me and he said, this is to help, just when I began the journeys, he said, this is to help you see in the dark. And it was such a strong gift. It made me realize that darkness isn't blindness. Darkness is actually a place where we can see things we'd never understand anywhere else.
And Robert McFarlane, your book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey, is like, it's kind of like an owl for me. It helps me see in the dark. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for your tour guiding, your inspiration.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
Listen to my leaves flutter. Hear my heart would breathe.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. We had studio help this week from Arizona Public Media in Tucson. You'll find more each week at ricksteves.com/radio.